This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. In 1998, Rob Billott was a young lawyer working with large corporations to address environmental laws and regulations. His life and career took an unexpected turn when he got a phone call from a West Virginia farmer named Earl Tennant. Mr. Tennant was convinced his cattle were being poisoned by liquids coming from a nearby landfill, one that was owned and operated by the chemical giant DuPont.
Agreeing to help Earl, Rob ultimately gains access to hundreds of thousands of pages of DuPont documents that reveal the company had been holding on to decades of studies proving the harmful effects of PFOA, a chemical used in the making of Teflon.
What starts as the case of one farmer soon spawns a class action lawsuit on behalf of 70,000 residents, and the numbing realization that virtually every person on the planet has been exposed to PFOA and carries the chemical in his or her blood.
We'll speak with Rob Billott about this amazing true story and his book titled Exposure: Poisoned Water, Corporate Greed, and One Lawyer's 20-Year Battle Against DuPont.
Robert, thank you so much for taking the time, and I'm sure which is always a very busy days for you, to join us this morning on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's a huge story. It's an incredible book. I thought we would start with just some background and history on the quote-unquote players in this story. And the first one would just simply be Parkersburg, West Virginia. Can you take a minute to describe Parkersburg, West Virginia?
Sure. It's actually a town where my mom and her whole family grew up and where I spent a lot of time as a kid. So I know the town well. It's a small community along the Ohio River called the Mid-Ohio Valley. It's a community where there are a number of chemical plants up and down the Ohio River. And in Parkersburg, in particular, one of the biggest employers in town historically had been the DuPont Company. So a lot of the folks in the community had either worked at the plant or had family members that worked there. Pretty close-knit community, everybody having a close ties with the chemical industry.
Right. So safe to say it's a corporate town, and there's a lot of DuPonters there who have a lot of allegiance to that company.
That's true.
So DuPont has a facility there called the Washington Works. And what is it that is being produced at the Washington Works?
Well, the DuPont Washington Works plant is actually one of the company's largest manufacturing facilities, built right around the time of World War II, and actually one of the world's largest Teflon manufacturing facilities. It makes all kinds of different products, but probably best known for the Teflon products.
So you have some really close ties to this community, as we learn about in the book, but you also became incredibly tied throughout your entire career to Parkersburg and DuPont through a case. So tell us how this kind of came to you. How did you become so involved in this?
Yeah, I had actually been working at a law firm in Cincinnati. In fact, I'm still working there. I've been there now 29 years, called Taft, Stathenius & Hollister. Started there right out of law school in 1990 and joined the environmental group. And most of what we did, at least the first 8 years or so of my career, I was helping chemical companies and other corporate clients comply with all the different state and federal environmental laws, pretty complex regulatory scheme, helping them comply with all these different rules and regulations. And I think it was around October 1998, I got a call in my office one day from a gentleman whose name I didn't recognize, and he started talking quite feverishly about cows dying on his property. I had no idea what he was talking about. In fact, I was about to hang up when he mentioned that he had gotten my name from my grandmother. And so I paid a little closer attention and found out that he had gotten my name actually from a neighbor of my grandmother's. So they had been talking earlier that day, and he was looking for a lawyer who might be able to help him, somebody outside of the Parkersburg community who could take a look at the problem he was having on this property. And after I heard that this is coming through my grandmother, I said, sure, come on up. We'd be happy to take a look at whatever you have and see if that's something we can help you on.
And describe to us like what he was experiencing and what he brought to show you.
Yeah, he showed up in our offices with armed with boxes of VHS videotapes, photographs, all kinds of documentation of what he was seeing, not only on his property, but the surrounding area, dead wildlife, deer, fish, frogs, birds, but in particular, the cows that he had on his property that his family had been taking care of for many years. He had lost over 100 animals, and he was quite convinced that it was due to something, some material in water that was coming out of a landfill right near his property, and that water was flowing through a creek that his cattle drank out of. And we could see in the videotape white foaming water coming out of a discharge pipe. So it looked pretty obvious to us there was something coming out of that landfill. And we could see the cows standing in the water. These animals, were basically looked like they were wasting away. They had tumors, blackened teeth. It looked pretty clear to us there was definitely a serious problem going on here.
And did he try to get some type of relief or assistance from the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection?
You know, what he had told us is he had tried. He had called the company. He had called the state Environmental Protection Agency. He had called the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. He had called local veterinarians. And unfortunately, he was reporting to us that he was getting essentially no response, no help. Nobody really wanted to get involved in the matter once they heard it related to DuPont. Again, one of the biggest employers in the area. So he felt that the only way he was going to get any assistance was going outside that community, looking for somebody who wasn't part of the Parkersburg DuPont community to help him out. That's how he reached out to us.
And so when he came to your firm and you talked to him about this, you know, did you think to yourself, will my firm ever allow me to take this case on? We kind of like, you know, as you talk about in the book, you worked with and defended these large corporations and helped them navigate these regulations. And so you thought really highly of a lot of the folks involved. And so just tell us about that process of taking on the case and the decision that you and the firm had to make.
Sure. You know, it was definitely an unusual situation for us. I mean, this was definitely not the kind of thing we typically did, not the kind of client we typically represented at the time. But, you know, when we looked at what he brought to us and what was, to us at least, so obvious in the videotapes and the photographs, we thought this would be fairly straightforward. We could pull the permits for this landfill and find out what kind of regulated chemicals were there and try to find out what was being discharged above those limits. This is the kind of thing we did all the time. Mm-hmm. So we thought, yes, it's a risk taking on a case like this, because this became our first contingency fee case, a case where the clients, you know, would not be paying by the hour, but only, only if something actually got recovered for them. But again, we thought this could be fairly straightforward. We'd pull the permits, we'd find out what regulated listed materials were there and get to the bottom of it. But unfortunately, when we dug in further, we weren't finding anything in the permits that was jumping out to us that would explain what we were seeing. And it was only after really digging in and getting additional documents from DuPont that we realized we were dealing with a completely unregulated chemical that essentially nobody really was familiar with outside the company.
Yeah, and this chemical we talked about in introduction is called it's PFOA, which is short for perfluorooctanoic acid. I guess from this point, we'll just refer to it as PFOA. But you're saying that you had to really figure out yourself that this chemical was in this leachate or this runoff.
That's right. That's right. You know, when we started off the case, the company was was saying, sure, we'll provide you all the permits, we'll provide you all the information about the regulated listed materials in our landfill. And then when we realized that really wasn't explaining, it wasn't giving us information about what we were seeing happening in the animals, that we started asking for additional records beyond just what was in the permits. And it was only then that we found out through looking at the internal company documents, and we had to go to court, you know, to get court orders to get these documents turned over to us. You know, I explain a little more detail about that in the book, about how difficult that was. Yeah. But once we finally got those documents, we started seeing that this chemical, PFOA, had been used at the Washington Works plant for decades, and that over 7,000 tons of it had been disposed of in this very landfill. And what does it do when it hits the water? It foams. So it took a while, but we finally figured out that what we thought was really the culprit here, harming the cows and impacting the whole area, was this mystery PFOA chemical.
And so why was DuPont so reluctant to share this information with you?
Well, what we eventually discovered after several years of digging through the files and fighting back and forth in court was this was a chemical that DuPont had been purchasing since 1951 that was critical for the company in their manufacturing of Teflon at the Washington Works plant. And it was a very valuable product for them that they had been purchasing for many years. You know, it was essentially unregulated because the company that was making it, 3M, up in Minnesota, who actually invented the chemical right after World War II and started making it shortly thereafter, you know, this chemical was brought out onto the market decades before there was a U.S. EPA and decades before some of the first federal regulations that even required us to start looking into what kind of safety standards and tests should be done on new chemicals before they come out onto the market. So we were looking at a chemical that was, you know, had critical uses for DuPont and was essentially unregulated at the time.
So did DuPont and 3M have any idea of these, you know, harmful impacts that the chemical could cause?
Yeah, that was particularly disturbing as we started digging through these files, and I started piecing together the history here of what we were seeing in these internal documents. Is even though the chemical was essentially unregulated and the regulators didn't know much about it, if anything, not only DuPont but 3M had been studying the toxicity and unusual properties of this chemical going back into the 1950s. And what we saw was the companies were well aware this was a pretty unique, unusual material, completely man-made, did not exist on the planet prior to World War II, and it had very unusual properties. Its chemical structure, carbons linked to fluorine, made it extremely difficult to break down. So once it got out into the environment, it would essentially stay there forever. And you hear it now referred to as a forever chemical. But not only would it get out into the environment and stay there, it was toxic. And we saw studies back in the 60s, animal studies confirming all kinds of toxicity. And by the 80s, studies confirming it was a carcinogen. DuPont itself classified PFOA internally as a confirmed animal carcinogen by 1988.
Wow.
And what we then saw was the companies were aware not only was this chemical toxic, it would stay in the environment, but if it got out and got into living things, including people, it would get in the blood and build up to higher and higher levels over time. So it was toxic, persistent, and bioaccumulative. We saw pretty disturbing information about the toxicity of the chemical. But what really was disturbing is when we saw then that the company, realizing it was emitting it into the air from its Teflon manufacturing operations, into the Ohio River, dumping it into landfills where it seeped into the ground, company went out and started testing public water supplies in the early 1980s and found it in the water. And unfortunately, the community drinking it wasn't told, and the regulators weren't told. So we became sort of the only ones that really we're seeing this story as we look through the internal documents, and I became very concerned that we were dealing with a major public health threat that the public and the regulators probably had no idea about.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Rob Billott. He is an environmental attorney and the author of a new book titled Exposure, Poisoned Water, Corporate Greed, and One Lawyer's 20-Year Battle Against DuPont. So you said DuPont then knew of the health impacts associated with PFOA, for as early as the 70s and 80s, and 3M knew this as well, correct?
3M was doing a lot of the toxicity studies as well. 3M was also monitoring its own workers. It was fully aware that this chemical was getting into the blood of its workers as well, yes.
And was even identified on what's called their material safety data sheet, which all chemicals come with, you know, a sheet that outlines what the chemical is, you know, how to handle it safely. It's a very standard template. And right there, I think you say in 1997 or 98, they had an MSDS sheet that that 3M identified this as a cancer-causing chemical.
Correct. Yes. A 3M material safety data sheet was sent to DuPont in 1997 that very explicitly said, you know, that this chemical can cause cancer, and referred to the two studies that had been done at that point that had confirmed exposure to PFOA had caused three different types of tumors in animal studies, testicular, liver, and pancreatic tumors.
So
that's the studies that prompted DuPont to internally classify it as a confirmed animal carcinogen.
So in reading through this documentation that you acquired, did you get a sense of, like, what these backroom conversations looked like? What did these sound like when they were saying, well, okay, we know this is a carcinogen in mammals, and we know that we're releasing it into the environment, and we know that it's impacting our workers, but we're not going to share this information, or we're not going to change our chemical usage. Like, how did those conversations go? What was being weighed in those conversations?
Yeah, we did gain some incredible insight to what was going on in the background through a lot of the discovery over the years and getting into the internal files. For example, we found a memo from 1984 from internal deliberations in Wilmington, Delaware, after the chemical had been found in the public drinking water, and the company trying to decide what to do at that point, whether to stop using it, should they go forward. You know, unfortunately, the decision was made they were going to go forward, and in fact, emissions skyrocketed over the next decade. You know, and what we saw also was internal struggles within the company. You had scientists and lawyers within the company, you know, very clearly warning, "Hey, you know, this is a problem chemical. We ought to do things to reduce it and to reduce emissions." We even had draft press releases at various points in time, you know, where the company was preparing to make the information available but chose not to.
Well, so what was DuPont's position this entire time? What was their message to the public?
Well, you know, it was a fairly consistent message, which was, you know, we have no evidence that exposure to this chemical at the levels the communities exposed to can cause harm. You know, so despite what they had seen in their own animal studies, despite what was shown in the worker studies, the company's position was, well, but the community is exposed to lower levels, and nobody can prove that those lower levels actually cause harm. Even though, you know, we're talking about a chemical that was unregulated, yet the company itself had set a community exposure guideline for how much of this chemical should be allowed in water. And the levels they were finding were 2 to 3 times that.
Now, I'm going to jump in because I have gotten two questions from listeners in a rapid succession here that are asking about the Sundance documentary that, of course, was about this issue. And yes, this is the same court case and issue that we're talking about here. But let's also take a minute to mention that this is also going to be in an upcoming film this fall, right?
That's correct. The story was addressed in a documentary, which, like as you just mentioned, was at the Sundance Film Festival a year or so ago. It's also going to be the subject of a film by Participant Media and Focus Features called Dark Waters, which comes out November 22nd.
Right, and that documentary that was here at Sundance was called The Devil We Know. It was here in 2018. I know we're running out of time. How did the case you go to trial with Mr. Tenet, and without giving away too much, and we don't want to, you know, we want people to read the book, and believe me, the book is incredible
and a wonderful read.
Yeah. But how does that case unfold?
Yeah, actually, with Mr. Tenet's case, once we found out that we found out about this mystery chemical, and we realized that so much of it had been disposed of in the landfill, his case settled. We settled his case for him. But what happened is the information we had learned during his case revealed that this was in the entire community's drinking water. So we ended up bringing a class action lawsuit on behalf of the 70,000 or so folks in the surrounding community who had it in their water. That was eventually settled in 2004. People got clean water, and we set up this rather unique process of an independent science panel to independently confirm what drinking the chemical would actually do to people at the levels in the community, since the company was still saying, you know, that there was no proof that it could cause harm. And after 7 years of study by that panel, the panel confirmed by 2012 that the chemical drinking in the water was linked with 6 different diseases, including 2 types of cancer, including testicular cancer. The same kind of, you know, remember the very first animal study that found cancer with PFOA was testicular tumors. So after that case, and after those findings came out, there were 3,500 individual lawsuits filed by people who had one of these diseases. And those were all, we actually did take some of those to trial. Mm-hmm. DuPont was found liable. In fact, punitive damages for conscious disregard of the risks were awarded by 2 juries. And during the fourth trial, DuPont settled all of those pending cases for about $670 million.
So, yeah, conscious disregard, you say in the book, too, it says if we went to trial, we could claim not only negligence, but conscious disregard, which in legal language often has the appropriately scary designation of, quote unquote, actual malice. So they actually knew this chemical was harmful, and they still did nothing about it to protect public health. That's actual malice, in a sense.
That's correct, and we presented all of these facts to 3 different juries in Columbus, Ohio, and we had 2 juries come back and find that those facts supported actual malice, a conscious disregard of the risks.
So I know this is kind of a rhetorical question, but what do you think DuPont could have done to really avoid this issue, this situation, because, well, I'll ask you first. What do you think they could have done to make this not a problem?
Well, I think, you know, if information had been provided to the government and regulatory agencies when information about substantial risk had been developed, the regulatory agencies could have looked into this probably decades ago, mm-hmm. and we would have been much closer to protecting the public at this point. You know, and at one point, 3M decided to actually stop manufacturing the chemical mm-hmm. in the year 2000. After looking at the data it had about the toxicity and persistence. But DuPont, rather than stop using it, actually jumped in to start making it itself and continued to do so for several years until after being sued by the EPA in 2004, DuPont agreed to phase out production of the chemical in 2006, and they agreed to phase it out over the next 10 years. So by 2013, they had finally stopped making it.
So what is the regulation around PFOA look like now? Mm. How is this chemical regulated now?
Well, as this information that we generated through our litigation has made its way finally to these regulatory agencies, the regulators and the scientific community that's looking at it are very alarmed. by the data about the chemical. There are a number of states that have jumped in to try to set appropriate drinking water guidelines and safety limits. The concern being that, you know, even though I think I first notified US EPA of these hazards and the health threat back in 2001, the US EPA has still not set a drinking water standard for this chemical. They've issued informal guidelines.
Right.
So states are moving forward in the meantime, trying to take action to protect the public. And as the chemical has popped up in more places across the country, as testing has occurred, it's not that the chemical is just now being released. It's people are just now testing for it.
Right.
And as people realize the scope of the exposure, you're seeing more regulatory agencies jump in. And the levels that they are setting as safety guidelines are getting lower and lower and lower. We're almost at the point where if it's detectable, agencies are recommending it be filtered out and people be protected from it.
Yeah, it's, again, it's a fascinating story about, you know, the individual impacts associated with chemical, how DuPont reacted to all this, how the state regulatory agency in West Virginia kind of pushed aside efforts to look into this, and the story kind of behind that too, including the Department of the West Virginia State toxicologist, who admitted in a deposition that she regularly destroyed her notes after every meeting. That was pretty shocking, wasn't it, Rob?
Well, it was definitely an eye-opening lesson for me on what happens, you know, in some of these interactions between the regulators and the regulatees.
Yes.
And the close connections, unfortunately, in some jurisdictions, such as West Virginia, where there are close ties between the folks who are doing the regulating and the people that are being regulated. You know, in this particular case, we had lawyers who were representing the company. You know, you've all heard about the revolving door. We almost had sort of the reverse revolving door.
Mm.
Lawyers that were representing the company who then left their private law firm and became the heads of the West Virginia EPA, enforcing the orders against DuPont.
Right.
Wow.
So, and cases continue, right? Are you still involved in cases?
Yes. You know, as PFOA has been detected in more places across the country, we're realizing it's not just PFOA, but it's a whole suite of related chemicals called PFAS, P-F-A-S. PFOA is just one of the PFAS chemicals. And we're now realizing a number of these chemicals are not only in drinking water across the country, but they're also in everyone's blood. And one of the things we're hearing now, as these additional chemicals pop up, it's almost like we're going back to the original refrain. Well, there's no evidence to suggest that these cause harm to people drinking them. So I've actually just filed a new case in Ohio, in federal court in Ohio, seeking to require the companies who put the chemicals out there to pay for scientific studies to confirm what the health risk is from these chemicals. Because unfortunately, you know, the way our legal system works, the folks that are exposed are told they have the burden to prove whether the chemical is harming them. And so I'm trying to set up a mechanism where the companies who put it out there, I mean, got it into our blood, they are the ones who should be funding the scientific studies, not the taxpayers.
Have you ever had your blood tested for levels of PFOA?
I have not, because I live down the Ohio River, and you know, there's already been testing done of the communities here outside of Cincinnati and the Cincinnati side of the river and in the northern Kentucky side of the river, and we already know we have pretty significantly elevated levels in our blood, even hundreds of miles away from the plant.
Yeah, because like you say, if we've used Teflon pans and maybe Scotch guards, furniture that's Scotch guarded, PFOA and PFAS, that family of chemicals could have a way to get into ourselves through ingestion or inhalation and then get into our bloodstream. So,
right. I mean, we're talking about chemicals when we talk about not just PFOA, but the related chemicals like PFOS, mm-hmm. which has been used historically in firefighting foams, and this broader PFOS class of chemicals. We're talking about materials, chemicals that have been used in a wide variety of products, fast food wrappers, packaging, carpeting, etc. So there's widespread exposure.
Could you ever have imagined that your career would have taken this turn and been entirely focused on this area of environmental law? Did you anticipate that when you started down this road?
No. I think I could say when Mr. Tenet walked in my office in 1998, 1999, I had no idea, you know, this is where it would lead us, that we would be dealing with this unregulated chemical and find out that it's not just his family, but essentially the entire world that's been contaminated.
Robert Billott is a partner at the law firm Taft, Statinius & Hollister in Cincinnati, Ohio, where he has practiced environmental law and litigation for nearly 30 years. Might I add, he's also a graduate of New College in Sarasota, Florida. And I say that because my niece graduated from New College just a couple of years ago. It's a great school. Congratulations.
Terrific. Yeah.
And he's also the author of the new book, Exposure: Poisoned Water, Corporate Greed, and One Lawyer's 20-Year Battle Against DuPont. I know we talked, you know, I hope we didn't give away too much, but believe me, we didn't. There's so much more in this book about great stories and stories within the story about how this issue unfolded and how Rob got to the bottom of it, basically. Rob, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again for joining us.
Thank our underwriters who make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Vail Resorts, Epic Promise,
Rocky Mountain Power,
Jones Waldo Park City, Attorneys at Law,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
and of course, listeners like you.
You can always email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth, all one word, at kpcw.org.